This podcast is a collaboration between Costard and Touchstone Productions and the Dads from the Crypt podcast.
Tickets, please.
Through the turnstile, grab a snack. Popcorn's popped. Now just lean back on the screen. Oh, what a surprise. The picture shrinks down to Barbie size.
Cool.
Welcome to another episode of the How Not to Make a Movie podcast. I'm Alan Katz. Gil will join us shortly. Before we plunge ahead, you know the drill. If you like, don't keep it to yourself. Better yet, subscribe. That way you'll stay current with everything we're doing, including our brand new streaming horror black comedy series, Are You Afraid?, which we're taking out to the marketplace as we speak.
To a flesh-eating ghoul, it's human fear that makes human meat taste so awesome. Flesh-eating ghouls especially like it. When the flesh they're eating tastes of fear, they themselves imprinted upon it. That means their human meat meal had to know them. Betrayal. That's the flavor flesh-eating ghouls love most.
Some people make an impact on us, and we never know their names. In this year's Oscar race, Barbie got lots of love, but its director, the extremely talented Greta Gerwig, got dissed. Greta took a cultural icon and peeled it open brilliantly. But in order for her to do that, first Barbie had to become a cultural icon. Today's guest, Andrew Gollarani, had a hand in making that first step happen. In the 1990s, when Barbie resurged, Andrew was the person responsible for directing the bulk of Mattel's Barbie ads. Now, the work itself, by design, was perfunctory. It was a house style, and the point of the exercise was to sell dolls, not the director. For Andrew, it wasn't the most creatively challenging work, but he had other outlets for that: music, writing, independent filmmaking. Andrew's a wonderful storyteller that Hollywood so far has missed. Good thing you're here listening to this podcast. You won't miss Andrew. And unlike Barbie, he comes with all accessories included.
Well, this is super fun, you guys.
Well, that remains to be seen, doesn't it? I mean, that could happen. It's always one of the possibilities of shit that can happen. Anyway, we all ready to rock and roll?
Sure. Let's have a chat. Sounds
indeed.
Fun.
Let's do it. You've been a filmmaker... Have you been a filmmaker your whole life? I mean, at what point in your youth did movie making take over? You were a musician when you were at St. John's.
Correct.
But you were there studying film and television, so it was already apparently in you.
Right.
Can you remember the first movie that... can you remember the first movie that you remember?
Yeah, I remember being scared the hell out of me was the original Mummy with Boris Karloff, going, oh my God. I remember when they pulled his tongue out and cut his tongue off. It was like, oh my God, you know, it was terrifying. And then,
how old were you at the time?
I was pretty young, you know, I remember when that movie was made, but I was, 10, 12, maybe, I don't know, something like that. But it was really scary. It was really scary. And then I remember the first magical movie that kind of, lit my fascination was the original Journey to the Center of the Earth. Mm. You know, way back in the day when Pat Boone and James Mason and they were, the giant mushrooms and the underwater ocean and all of that was just like magic. I'm sure if I saw it again today, it would be like so cheesy. Center Earth was mostly mechanical effects and oversized props and green screens. It was amazing, at least at the time. And then to answer your question, music, I started playing drums when I was about 10 or 11. And I think what happened is that, when you're playing music, at least for me, I was always visualizing stuff. The music would take you someplace visually. And I kind of went, this is kind of interesting. And then I did that, all through college and after college and kicked around in the rock and roll world for a couple of years. But I always visualized stuff, hearing to the music.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Because, all right, I've never, I don't know that I've heard another musician say that part of their creative process, as the music is happening, they're visualizing stuff. Does do the visualizations match to the music? Is there any connection to them, between them?
Well, you know, not that I can recall specifically, but I just remember that it would take me places, imaginary places, and I love that. And then eventually, you know, the music. I was a drummer, so you were dependent on your other bandmates, and you know, bandmates are notoriously unreliable. You know, so if I had been a lead singer or a writer or a guitar player, I probably would have, you know, could have done something more on my own. But as a drummer, I was kind of stuck. And, you know, when that all came crashing down, when people did, you know, too many drugs and too much booze, it was like, this is not going to be a future for me. And so I, you know, having majored in communication arts and, you know, and sciences, broadly speaking, I said, okay, well, you know, I might as well go and, you know, explore the film business. If I was going to explore the film business, I might as well do it in Hollywood, you know, so that, because if you remember, you know, New York in the 70s was a cesspool. So I didn't want to stay in New York, and I didn't know much about the, you know, the industry anyway. So to me, it was like, you know, it's Hollywood, that's where you go. So that's what I did. I just came, you know, packed up my drums and put them in my 67 station wagon, my long hair, and I drove to California.
You were rather pragmatic about it. It was, well, yeah. Like Willie Sutton towards Banks, because that's where the money is.
Well, yeah. And I remember driving into Los Angeles, it would have been like September, driving into Los Angeles in the middle of the hills. I drove down the Hollywood Freeway, came in from the north, drove down the Hollywood Freeway, and both sides of the freeway were on fire. It's like, welcome to Los Angeles, right?
What year was this?
This would have been 75, you know, wow. September of 75. And, you know, I was saying, okay, well, here we go. The hills are on fire. Welcome to Los Angeles. And of course, the air in LA was terrible in the 70s, too.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Like, you know, here you go. What did I do? But it was still the place to be. And I knew that's where I had to be to, you know, to kind of...
Really interesting place to have moved into when you moved in 1975, because there was a huge transition happening in terms of really the whole creative center of the town.
Well, I wouldn't know, you know, because I was just a newbie. So it was kind of I had one connection. One of my professors he ended up working for Don Kirshner's rock concerts. So he was my only contact in LA to speak of. So I did get in touch with him, but it didn't lead to anything. Which was fine. But I, you know, I was long friends with, the time I was a teenager, I was really close friends with, an actor named Jeff Conaway, who played, Kinnicky in Greece.
And, sure,
Bob
sure.
Wheeler on Taxi. So, you know, I came out to L.A. and I crashed with Jeff and his girlfriend, Carol Demas, for the first 6 months that I was out here. And basically, I just kind of there was a studio guide, little red and blue, you know, a paperback studio guide that was kind of the precursor of the L.A. 411 and what have you. And I just went through the guide and I circled everything that was geographically, you know, together. And I put on a suit and tie, because that's what you did when you grew up in New York and you went on a job interview. And I just went studio to studio, you know, trying to get a job. And I stumbled into a company, a TV production company on Sunset Boulevard called Wakeford Orloff. And they were one of the half dozen, you know, big commercial guys at the time. And I walked in and there was a... they had about six or eight directors, and there was a production coordinator who did all the crews for all the different directors. I met Abby Sands, wonderful gal, still friends. And she said, she's okay, well, you know, come back after the new year and, you know, we'll get you something. She said, by the way, don't wear the suit and tie. You know, so I did. I came back. I got a job there. At the beginning of the year, I made $30 a day sweeping sound stages. And that's where it all started. I had one thing led to the other, and met some people, and went up the ladder a little bit, and there you go.
So, before we completely lose track of your music years, I just want to note that it says in your bio that you performed with such acts as Chuck Berry and the Jay Giles Band.
That's right. Yeah, we were.
Sneeze that. Wow, cool.
It was cool. We got to opening act status. What I mean by that is we got out to like opening act status.
Oh, I got you. Okay,
so
okay.
We had the same manager as Tommy James and the Shondells at the time, and so we opened for Tommy quite a bit, which was great. I remained friends with his drummer for years until he passed away prematurely out here in L.A., which is a shame. But we played with Chuck Berry, we played with Jay Giles, we played with Tommy James, we played with I can't remember now, but. But, you know, really fun stuff. But again, it was just going to not go anywhere. Ultimately, our manager was greedy. He kept us busy in the club circuit and doing concerts like that, and never enough time to be in the rehearsal studio, writing and producing and getting ready to do a record. And so we never got there. And he kept us, in debt by also, you know, funding all of our equipment. So it was this vicious cycle that we weren't going to get out of. And I could see the writing on the wall. It all ended up in a big fist fight one night, not between me, thank God, between the guitar player and the keyboard player. And I said, you know, guys, this is crazy. I'm sorry. I'm out of here. So, you know, yeah, there you go. But that was fun times. That was really good. It was really great times.
Up until then,
yeah, exactly.
But okay, so now you're in Los Angeles. You're finding your way in. What did you really want to accomplish? All right, so now you're here. You're sweeping up studios during the day. But what did you really want to do? Did you really want to direct?
Well, yeah, exactly. The old adage. Yes, I came out to become a director. And I didn't know how that was going to happen. I just knew that it was probably a good idea to be in Hollywood if you wanted to do that.
Who were the directors in your head at that point that you were emulating?
Let's see. I'm not sure there was anyone in particular. 75, 76. I guess Scorsese was doing some. When was Mean Streets? Mean Streets must have been right around then.
75, I think.
Yeah, something like that. But
73, but actually.
Actually, when you say that, it's not so much the directors. I loved the Rat Pack vibe from the Rat Pack era of you know the that part of Hollywood that kind of late 60s into early 70s Hollywood just seemed so magical and cool.
Yeah.
That I remember, for instance, being really, really impressed. I was much younger, but being really impressed with Jerry Lewis in his Buddy Love character in The Absent-Minded Professor, you know, the cool suits and the velvet collars. And, you know, it was just, in fact, my Easter outfit was a blue suit with a velvet collar, you know, which was, there was something about that whole era that just was, you know, kind of Hollywood. And I think that's more than anything probably what drew me to the West Coast. Plus, I hated being in New York and freezing my ass off. I always was cold. I wanted to be warm, you know, so I wanted to be in LA.
You know, I will make a note that up until today, people used to say, well, hey, the weather sucks here in the East, but at least we don't have earthquakes.
Yeah, really? Yeah, incredible.
Yeah, now the weather sucks and you have earthquakes.
And you have earthquakes.
It took all this time for them to catch up to the West Coast so they can have earthquakes.
Hey, can we just say...
They will rebuild.
Now, just to be fair, all three of us are East Coasters transplanted to the West Coast. But having been on the West Coast for a long, long time, I mean, I've been out here since 1985, Gil since roughly the same amount of time. Listening to East Coast people talk about an earthquake is like listening to the first guy who ever got pregnant or talk about what it was like to give birth. Like no one else had ever experienced this. It was, wow.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Okay, it's enough already.
Yeah, it's pretty funny stuff.
And the news coverage, look, literally nothing happened. Nobody got hurt. Right. Nothing fell off a goddamn shelf. And you are going hack this thing like it was the second coming of Jesus, for fuck's sake.
Somebody on Facebook just posted a picture of a rock that slid down. That was like it, you know. Our son is over in New Jersey, and he was about, you know, 30 miles from the epicenter. So, and having been raised in California, he knew exactly what it was. His fiancee was like, "What is this?" She's a Jersey girl. And it was like, yeah. So he was like, "Oh, that's an earthquake. That's haven't felt that in a while." But he knew exactly what it was. But yeah, everybody's fine.
So you're looking to direct. All right, how do you get from point A to point wherever the fuck that is?
Well, you know, I can't remember who said this, but sometimes at some point in my career, somebody said everybody gets there differently. They get there their own way. And, you know, I come out of college with a degree in film and television, but didn't mean squat. You know, you needed to get a job. It's kind of a long story, but when I first started college, in my first week or two, we had a very hotshot young dean of the communications department. And he was tapped into kind of the old school media of New York in the 70s. And he put together a symposium and he got Joseph E. Levine, who had just done the Graduate. He got Larry Pierce, who had just directed Goodbye Columbus. He was the film critic for Playboy at the time. Bruce Williamson.
Bruce Williamson, okay.
Bruce Williamson for Playboy and Kathleen Carroll for the New York Daily News, which was when it was a respectable paper. You know, so he had this symposium. It was really cool. You know, I'm a freshman in college. How do I know? But, you know, because you're also young and you have no boundaries and you just do stuff. So the symposium ends, and I go up to Joseph E. Levine, who had made his, he was a schmata salesman. He had made his money in the trades and the garment business. Got into producing movies, and he was everything you expect, the cigar smoking, the schmata salesman. So I go up to Joseph E. Levine and I say, "Hey, Mr. Levine, I want to be a director someday," and blah, blah, blah. And he's smoking on a cigar, blah, blah, blah. He says, yeah, it's great, kid. Yeah. Talk to my PR guy right here, you know? So he hands me over to his public relations guy, a guy named Larry something, who goes, "Yeah, give me a name, give me a phone number, all that stuff." Okay, great. This is September. Nothing comes of it. December of that same year, just before Christmas, I get a phone call from Larry, the PR guy. He calls me at my mom's house in Flushing, and he says, "Mr. Levine is shooting a movie in New York, and he'd like you to be a guest on the film for a week." And I went, "Wow, what a Christmas present." So I did. I spent a week, on the set. First time I've ever been on a set in my life. It was a TV movie with Eli Wallach and maybe Ann Jackson, I can't recall. Not a great film, except that it was being, the AD on the job was a guy named Terry Donnelly, who had done French Connection and The Exorcist with Billy Friedkin. And he took me under his wing and kind of said, "When the light is on, you don't talk, you hear the bell, you shut up. All those things was what you have." Oh, Hal Holbrook was also in it, which was great. And so I spent a week, in this magical environment. They had reproduced an entire interior of a Scarsdale house on the Filmway Studios up in Harlem, which again, I had never seen anything like that. It was incredible. And I did stuff that, I probably shouldn't have done. I went into the dailies, and watched the dailies. And you finally said, "You can't go in and do the dailies with the director. You can't do that." But it was fantastic, wonderful experience. All through college, all through playing music, a couple of years in LA. Now I'm a production assistant. I've worked my way up to a production assistant. And I walk into a pre-pro at the same company, Wakeford Orloff. And here is Terry Donnelly, who was ADing a commercial for one of the directors. And I was like, "Oh my God." So we reconnect. And a couple more months later, it goes on, I get a call from Terry, and he says, "I'm doing a movie. I'm working with Paul Mazursky. I'm doing a small picture. I want you to production manage the West Coast part of the shoot, a couple of weeks. out of 20th Century Fox. I want I'm not in the Directors Guild. He says, I can't put you on, you know, but I'll put you on as location manager, which was a non-union job at the time. But I really want you to do the shoot. So I said, done. So I'm now sitting in an office in 20th Century Fox, you know, doing the West Coast production for this movie called Willie and Phil with Paul Mazursky. And, you know, that just led me to getting close with the VP of production at Fox, a guy named Herb Wallerstein, who took me under his wing. And he kept me on afterward to work on 9 to 5. He wanted me to work on 9 to 5 with Colin Higgins and Lillian Jane. And I did that for about 10 weeks and it was going nowhere.
But you really learned the nuts and bolts. It was nuts and bolts from the start.
Why do you think Josephine Levine called at that time?
I think he just saw a kid with ambition and had the balls to come up to him and say, "Hey, I want to be in the movie business." And he, for some reason, right, he remembered and had his PR guy reach out. It was just like, I was as shocked as anyone.
A rather menschy thing to have done.
Yeah, very, very.
Theoretically, good God, the education that he gave you an opening to. I mean, look, you could have showed up on set and just been a tourist.
Exactly, exactly.
You did what perhaps he expected you to do.
Yeah, I mean, God bless. One thing led to the next.
Yeah.
I think a lesson in all of that, basically, which has been true pretty much my entire career, is say yes. You know, just do it. Go for it. Mm-hmm. You know, worst that happens is you fail. But go for it. Don't hold back and regret it.
Totally agree. When I first got to LA in 1985, I think one of the first best thing I ever did was I met Gil Adler and we became creatively associated. But the second best thing I ever did was I took a couple of classes with the Groundlings.
Oh, wow.
And learning improv as part of my creative process. Well, the whole nature of improv is yes and.
Yes, right.
Exactly. And you're always adding information. The word that you never introduce into the creative process is no.
Right, exactly. Yes, and.
And so you might want to steer the creative endeavor in a direction that it's not in right now, but the challenge to you is to do it without saying the word no.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is to get there creatively and constructively.
Yeah. Well, it's that same company I worked for. When I was working on 9 to 5, and Colin Higgins, God bless him, was the sweetest man in the world. But he was, as a director, he was very insecure and unsure of where he wanted to go with stuff. And as a location manager, I was showing him locations that, as a young aspiring director, I could see working, you know, with a wild wall here. But he needed to literally see it as he had written it. And so we were like, you know, weeks and weeks over in pre-production. And I finally went to an opportunity came up with the DGA that they were going to grandfather. I guess they needed people. So they would open up the process and you just had to kind of, you know, pull your call sheets and time cards together and have enough to present to the DGA. But I had to go back and all the non-union companies I had worked with and kind of pull all the stuff together. So I went to Herb Wallace and I said, "Herb, I gotta leave this picture. I gotta get the Director's Guild." So he understood, and I left the picture before we started shooting, and went out and pulled together, you know, all the stuff that I needed to go to the guild to be able to get in, which was great. So I did get into the guild as a UPM, as an AD, and which was great because I never thought twice about it until I started looking at my retirement benefits about, you know, 20 years ago. I was like, whoa, that was a good move. And that kind of, you know, got me into union AD work but the funny thing was at the time, the work was in commercials. So I was in commercials all this time because it's where the work was. And it's kind of where I started and kind of where I kind of knew. So I just stayed in commercials and I actually liked that because you're always doing something different.
And yeah, that world has been really, really good to you. You've worked for done some award winning stuff for Case Swiss.
Yeah.
You've worked for Bank of America, the LA Times, Mazda, Taco Bell, Toyota.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Barbie.
Yeah. Yeah, Barbie was, yeah. I'm sitting in the house that Barbie built, as we say.
All right. So when was your period when you were directing Barbie commercials?
Well, first thing I did is that I spent 10 years learning the ropes, you know, as a stage sweeping PA, you know, production assistant, production manager, AD, producer. So 10 years or so went into that. And then about 85, I just got antsy. It was like, you know, it was really great. I was the same guy who hired me as a floor sweeper, I was now producing for. And we had a great office in West Hollywood, my own, you know, my own thing, my own staff. Everything was wonderful. But I was bored. It was basically, you know, what am I going to do here? How many Fisher Dollies can I order? So I called up a friend of mine who had just transitioned out of doing exactly the same thing into directing. He was an AD going into directing. And I said, Chris, you know, how did you do this and why? And he said, basically I got to a point where directing the $60,000 TV commercial was more exciting than producing the $500,000 Coca-Cola commercial. And he was exactly right, because what was missing from my days in the music world was the creativity side. I had all the production side, I had all the, you know, the organizational skills all that, but I was craving something creative. So I started saving my pennies and taking all my connections that I had made over 10 years of crew and everybody else, and I started shooting spec commercials. So in 1985, I shot my first spec commercial for Dr. Pepper, which is what we did. And then slowly over the next 18 months, I spent everything I had saved on five or six spec commercials. I pulled in all the guys I had worked with and did favors for, and, you know, and they did favors for me. And we slowly, my wife Candace is just, you know, 8 months pregnant, you know, serving soup at night for the crew. And slowly, you know, built a reel that didn't do much for me initially. I spent 9 months of hearing no, and going, oh my God, I just blew my whole savings and I'm going to fail at this. Until I got him all the way back to the first company I had ever talked to. Things had changed. They saw some additional work that I had done, and liked what they saw. They wanted to add a director on the West Coast. And so they hired me. Mm-hmm. And my first year as a director was better than my best year as a producer. And to get back to your point, part of what that was Barbie commercials. And I did supermarkets and Barbie spots my first year.
What year was that?
Well, first year that I was actually working as a paid director would have been 1988.
Wow. So, wow, you
know,
wow,
85
wow.
85 to 87, I put my reel together.
Wow.
I said no to taking jobs as an AD because they needed to see me as a director and not as an AD.
Mm-hmm.
And then you know, I got lucky and got signed. Although I will tell you, it was really painful. I remember so vividly going into a company at the time, was a fairly hot company, and presenting my reel to the executive producer, and you know, very cordial, thank you very much, you know, we'll be in touch. And as I left the room, the door was ajar, and as I got out into the hallway, I heard the two guys laugh. They just laughed at the work. They just thought, you know, it was just, you know, not what they wanted, but they were just really nasty about it, you know. That hurt so bad I kept that feeling with me for a long time, and swore that I would never do that to any other person I met in the business and make anybody else feel that way. And the great thing about that is that those guys are long gone. They crashed and burned that company, you know, about 3 years later. And I had a 28-year career in commercials. So it was
Have you ever thought just for the hell of it, if they're gone, to piss on their graves?
You know, that's the bad karma you don't want to incur.
Well, you're look, it's a matter of framing. You're watering.
But,
if they're in California, it's drought. You're doing a nicety.
Yeah. My sales, well, in commercials we have sales reps, not agents, you know, and they go out and they present your work to the different agencies. And my sales rep at the time, a really great gal, I'm still friends with, Leslie Young, took my reel over to Ogilvy and Mather in LA, who was doing the Barbie stuff. And they liked it. I don't know why. I didn't have any doll commercials, but they liked what they saw. And I think I had a meeting with them, I think, or something like that.
Do you have any idea what they were looking for in terms of a vision for their product?
You know, I don't. I really don't. I think it's because in those days it was the Barbie work in those days was really, really tightly structured. I mean, they had a formula, and I think what happened more than anything is that they burned through directors, because it's such difficult work, and they're so hard to work for. That I think they just burn through directors and always looking for new blood. I think it's probably as simple as that.
Yeah, I would imagine that's a rather second guessing, third guessing, fourth guessing every creative decision.
Yeah,
that kind of environment, and no one wants to make a decision, because then you can't cover your ass.
That's exactly right. And also, it was such a Barbie was such an icon at the time that nobody wanted to mess with the brand. You know, so they had their formula, and they just wanted to do what they wanted to do, and you needed to fit into that, which was okay. You know, it was fine. It was work, and that's kind of how I looked at it. And so that got me started doing that, and that was always a love-hate relationship, because they were, to talk about, fastidious work. That work is really tough work to do, because you're basically dealing with, some of the hardest elements in filmmaking. You're dealing with miniatures, which is an 11 and a half inch doll, high fashion, kids, and also every now and then they'll throw in an animal just to make you crazy, I was good at it. I just kind of,
What do you think about it you were good at?
I wasn't as patient as I am now, but I managed to hide that, because they will try your patience for sure.
By they, you mean your...
The agency, Yeah. I'm not quite sure, but I guess I just did good work for them. I mean, I approached it seriously. The funny thing about working on Barbie commercials, and it wasn't just Barbie, I was doing a lot of fashion dolls, different ones, Ariel, the Little Mermaid for Hasbro, and Cabbage Patch dolls. It just became this kind of golden handcuffs thing that happens where you get typecast in a certain category. It was just, I just took it seriously. I just took the work seriously. And just
obviously they were happy, because how many years did you have that account?
Oh God. I started it, I guess that would have been 1988, and I did it for them and other companies like Hasbro and smaller companies too, up until about 99, where I just couldn't do it anymore. It was just really difficult. It's really hard to work for, because they were so controlling.
Was there ever any latitude in the way that you got to direct the commercials?
Any what? I'm sorry?
Any latitude?
Well, yes and no. I mean, it was such an iconic brand that you kind of couldn't fuck with it, but you just tried to do the best you could with it. But it was really difficult, and the days were really long. I mean, there were days when we would, you know, we would shoot 20 hours, and just horrible. Every little hair was out of place. You had to account for. But you know, it was great training, and it paid well. And you know, I had a young family, and we were just you know, it was like, okay, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing, I guess. But after a while, I just couldn't take it anymore. As they just eat your soul up. And then this weird thing happened.
There was enough money in your bank account to buy a significant portion of your soul back.
Yes, it's true.
Okay. All right.
It's true. But so I got a call from somebody who had worked for the agency at the time and had gone off and was doing a new doll line called Bratz a company called MGA, a startup company called MGA. And we basically, she said, look, I want to be the un-Barbie. I want to do everything that Barbie wouldn't do. And I said, well, this sounds like fun. Let's do that. You know? So we did. So we started the Bratz, you know, campaign in 90 or 2000, I guess, something like 2000. And it exploded, because it was the anarchist dog. It was everything that your mother wouldn't want you to do. Which of course was great fun for us because we got to twist the knife, because she had worked for Mattel too, and she knew the pain. And so we got to twist the knife in Mattel. And
what were some moments when wow, you surely there were a couple of in jokes that got planted all over the place. What were absolute just to Mattel? What would be an example of one of those?
Oh God, let me see if I can remember. Because we did have some, it's a long
time. It had to be Easter eggs. You had to have been planting Easter eggs all over the damn place.
Yeah,
and just hoping that certain people saw them and got them and felt every last bit of that knife twisting in them.
Yeah, it's I'm sure we have them now. I can't.
Damn.
Yeah, it's a long time ago now, but we definitely had our fun being the un-Barbies, and it was amazing and it exploded. And we did that from 2000 until 2007, and then Mattel just gave up and they just said, we can't beat these guys. So they hired us back to come over back to Mattel and to.
Well, there you go. That's almost that. There you go. That's the best revenge. Obviously the knife stuck in deep.
Yeah. And, you know, and then gave us carte blanche, pretty much. They at that time, they had fired all the old Mattel people who were not delivering anymore because we were kicking their ass. And we got to kind of do that until, I don't know, until 2015, I think, when they changed guards again. And, you know, these things don't last forever. And, you know, but we had great fun doing all that stuff. And,
so you were really backed doing all that stuff until really quite recently.
Yeah, yeah. That kind of, I think we did our last Mattel spot in 2015, maybe, something like that.
Where was Barbie in the zeitgeist at that point? Do you remember?
Well, she was down and out because we had kicked her ass, you know, with the Bratz business. Which was really fun, but she was also struggling because they weren't quite sure what to do with her yet. Hasbro had been ahead of the curve and had taken their brands and took them into entertainment. So you had the Transformer stuff going on that Michael Bay was doing, and then you had the G.I. Joe stuff that was happening. So they had taken their brands and taking them into entertainment way earlier than Barbie could, and they tried. There was a few attempts to take Barbie out there. I think Diablo Cody took a shot at a script. Amy Schumer, strangely, was attached at some point to do a movie, which never went anywhere. And until, Margot Robbie and crew came along with this last go round, they never got off the ground. They never did, you know, so I'm not sure why, but, so we just were doing our thing out there. And just at some point, we just you can't do these accounts indefinitely. They're too hard to do. They're too demanding, and ultimately you just get tired of the same old, you know. So I just
how do you feel about Margot Robbie and Greta Gerwig's take on that creature that you spent an awful lot of time figuring out
how to
tell its story?
Yeah, they did a great job. They really I find it really interesting. One of the things I learned about working on dolls, right, is that men have a terrible time feeling valid doing it. It somehow messes with their masculinity. They get freaked out because they're doing a doll commercial, like they're a little girl or something. But I always approach it as fashion. You know, we approach it as we'd approach it as fashion, miniatures, and kids. You know, combined in the same spot, and I always took the work seriously, which is why I think I had such a long career doing it, because we took it seriously. Other people they were freaked out that they were working on dolls.
All storytelling is framing. Look, if you want to frame it from that place, then you're going to have a hard time telling the story that way. But if you choose to frame it differently, you might find a way that you can tell its story. Can do that.
And I'm living in the house that Barbie built. I mean, literally.
Just to be, because the house could be a shack in the middle of the high desert. In which case, dude, look, really, don't. But it is a nice house, right?
It's a nice house. Gil has an invite to stop by anytime he's driving down from Vancouver,
right?
To swing by. And
where are you living now?
We're on Vashon Island, just off of Seattle.
Huh.
Yeah. So it's we built our little dream house here back in 2011, and moved up full time in 2016. After we stopped doing the Barbie business, and we just didn't want to have a house in LA and a house in Seattle, just too much. So we just said, let's leave LA, you know. So we came up here. But where were we? I'm sorry.
but Barbie, you know, what Greta Gerwig what they did was they changed the framing.
Yeah, they it was really interesting. It's
Margot Robbie. I couldn't think of Margot Robbie's name. What they did collectively, creatively, was they reframed it in a way that I think they saw it in a whole fresh new way that allowed everyone to see it in a fresh new way. They re-enlivened the franchise in a way no one expected them to.
It's true. It's really true. But interestingly, I still think that, you know, I mean, they came up pretty empty in terms of fabulous box office, but they came up pretty empty in terms of the award shows. And it's the same weird macho curse that you get, you know, when you're working on quote girls' toys. And I think that was part of the backlash. You know, when you're up against Oppenheimer, there's just never been a certain amount of respect that the work gets, even if you do it really well, like they did. It doesn't get the respect it deserves. I personally
thought Barbie was a more interesting movie than Oppenheimer.
I've yet to see Oppenheimer, I have to confess, but it was, although I will tell you, it was interesting watching it, because you have this love-hate relationship. Mm-hmm. You know, you've worked on an account for so long and you've been through the good and the bad of it, you know, it's kind of like but they did a really good job. They did a really good job with it, and I think Greta did a really, really good job with it. It's a hard brand to wrap your head around and dive into with honesty. And she did. She did a really good job. You know?
A lot of men went to that movie who otherwise would never have gone to a movie that was about Barbie.
Yeah.
I went to that movie, not because it was about, well, yes, Barbie, but because it was making such a fascinating statement in such a wonderful, exciting way.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I don't know how you do much better than they did, actually. You know, it has a built-in, you know, prejudice, no matter what. It's always going to be a doll, you know, but I thought they did a really great job with it.
Putting the doll aside for a second, I mean, they really created a very contemporary story that spoke to women of all ages, but especially young women. And it really hit a nerve with a lot of women.
Yeah.
And with some men as well. And I think that's why it was so successful, because as you're watching it, you're really not thinking you're watching a movie about a doll. You're really watching a movie about a contemporary woman having issues and problems that my daughter, my wife, my cousin, they're having.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's why I think it hit such a great nerve.
It did. And you know, in the theater, I mean, the howls of recognition, you know, from the women, especially in the audience. And they just loved it. It was just like, oh, my God, that's so true.
My wife and daughter. Yes, yes, yes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It was fun watching it with them.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and Ryan Gosling, again, embraced it 110%, you know, went for it.
With the number he did on the Oscars, you know, that was fantastic. Holy shit.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Awesome.
Absolutely great. That's great. You have to give him credit for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, it was definitely, you know, a love hate experience sitting there, because I had been through some terrible shoots with them. And so, you know, you're scarred to a certain degree. And on the other hand, you go, good for you guys. Good for you for pulling this off, you know. Mm-hmm. So, and I love Margot Robbie. She's just great.
Would you compare it to, all right, you're the first wife. You've put up with all the shit years, and you watch the man go off and be with the second wife who gets all just the good stuff, because now he's mellowed and he's not an asshole, and suddenly he's easy to live with, and oh, there's money and.
Yeah, there's some of
that.
Boy,
that does suck, doesn't it?
Yeah, there's some of that for sure. You know, you go like, you want to go, well, hell, I could have done that movie, you know, but.
Yeah. If you just asked.
There you go.
Yeah. But you have gone on into make some movies and some little independent movies. And I happened to catch the role of Della.
And it was not fear for what frightened me, but for what might happen to you exactly as before I was your little skylark.
Do you have something else?
Excuse me?
Another monologue, something from the 20th century. I hate Ibsen.
Really?
If Nora were a true feminist, she would have smothered her children and had her husband killed.
When did you make that?
Right after I stopped doing the Mattel work in 2015.
Great little piece.
Well, thank you. It's
great little piece.
It's based on a little one act play.
It is that was my one question. It's a one act play, right? That's not a two. How do you make that last for two acts? Oh my God! What do you do for the intermission? Holy.
Yeah, yeah. No.
Good. I'm relieved to know that.
Yeah, it was. And I was just looking around for material, and I can't remember. Oh yeah, play scripts, which is a publication for, you know, one act plays, I think. So just looking out for material, and I came across it, and I said, oh, this is kind of fun. And I wanted to do something that was character driven and had a lot of dialogue. And, so I did that, and I went up to Vancouver, and I shot it with my crew in Vancouver. And God bless them. They all came out and did it for free. And, that was really fun. And so it was giving me a little, you know, stretch into something else.
It's a great little piece. It's about an actress has an audition. She turns up a little bit late, and she walks in, and the woman doing the casting is really hard. She is just the worst person. There are some twists and turns along the way. It's really a delightful, fun piece. Bravo.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Well, you should talk a little bit about the two pieces that you showed recently up here in Vancouver.
Well, yeah. Well, that's kind of an outgrowth of that, Gil, is, you know, I did Della up in Vancouver. And because I spent so much time shooting in Vancouver, so slowly over the years, you know, I basically got outsourced. You know, the business shifted economically, it shifted to Canada. So slowly over the years, I just kept doing more and more work in Vancouver. And so I built up this whole, you know, source resources in Canada, grew and everything else. So, yeah, so I did, I went up and did, you know, we did Della up there. And then we did the two that you just saw. What the hell, the names of my movies.
Oh, Killing Georgia Jones?
Yes, thank you. Killing Georgia Jones and did I screen? I did screen Lost too. Yeah. So.
Now I've only seen the trailer for Killing Georgia Jones, but that's rather taut.
It's really a great little movie, and I when we saw it and we were together, I said, you know, it'd be great to try to figure out how to expand that into a full a longer piece. I'm not sure how quite to do it, but it
Yeah.
was so different. It was so different, and I thought so well done. But I
Well, thank
really
you,
would like you
Mark.
to talk a little bit about the other piece
Well,
that you the short,
which one to go? Sorry.
the short about suicide.
Yeah, that Lost. Yeah, Lost. It's ironically, I'll share this with you guys. Al, it's a story of why am I guess well I guess I have to tell you about it, but it's a story of a guy who you know goes into the woods basically. You don't know quite why, but ultimately he's going in to take his life, and it was motivated by you know personal experiences in our life and unfortunate situations that have happened. And I just wanted to do something a little bit more, a little more gravitas to it, and actually hopefully make a difference, maybe find a resource that somebody can find some help and stop them from going all the way to that extreme, you know. So we did that, and we did that up there too, and just screened in LA at the film festival in LA, and we just accepted into Lee Strasberg's festival. To screen, I guess pretty soon. I'm not sure exactly when. So I'm
Talk a
already.
little bit about the reaction to that movie and how it's seems to have mushroomed out in terms of people being interested in using that to help and show people who are contemplating
Well,
what.
I would hope ultimately that that's what happens. It's I mean, for instance, the closing credit basically it says that any prize money or award money that comes from the film festival is going to be donated to a local, you know, suicide prevention, you know, hotline. So it's meant to, the most rewarding commercials I've ever done were public service spots, you know, where you maybe help somebody somehow, you know,
Right.
AIDS awareness, cancer, the things that you do pro bono that are, you know, just the most rewarding, you know, basically, because somebody said to me, what do you do for a living in commercials? And I said, well, I sell dog food. You know, which is, you know, one way or another, you're selling something. You're selling dog food. You know,
So you do that too, huh? Okay.
But you know, so the pro bono spots and the PSAs, the things that, you know, have some kind of gravitas to them, are the most emotionally rewarding that you can do. And they don't pay a dime. You know, you end up losing money usually. But you know, same thing with Lost, is that it came out of, you know, personal experience or experiences of close friends, and you know, and I hope it does make a difference. I hope somebody does see it and maybe reaches out and says, you know, okay, you know, I'm going to pull back from the edge here and ask for some help.
Is it available for people to download or stream or access?
It won't be until we finish the festival runs, because
Okay.
that's they always, you know, ding you if you.
Sure. Yes, of
You know,
course, of course. So at some point after you finish the festival runs, then the people will be able to see this. Cool.
Hopefully, I mean, for instance, not Della, but Killing Georgia Jones is available right now on shortverse.com. You know, so you can go to shortverse.com and
Okay.
put in the you know, put in the title and it'll come up, the page will come up and you can
shortverse.com.
Yeah, shortverse.com. Yeah.
We will create a link to it.
Yeah.
Lost is very, very unassuming and it sort of creeps up on you because, as you said, you don't really know what you're watching when you first see it. And you sort of are discovering stuff very cleverly shot so that you discover stuff along the way and you realize, oh my God, this guy, he's contemplating suicide. And then you realize, wait a second, this guy is actually going to commit suicide. And then it's not a very long movie,
no,
but it's very, very compelling. And it seems to me it would do a lot of good for a lot of organizations out there to see it and screen it and talk about it.
Well, ultimately that would be the end result. That would be the most satisfying, of course.
Sure.
And eventually that somehow, and I don't know yet. We've just, been in one festival and we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
But ultimately that would hopefully that it does, somebody does pick it up and somebody says, can we use this? What can we do with this? And I haven't reached out to any organizations yet about that and, offered it, for their use, which I would be happy to do.
Yeah.
But eventually we will.
Yeah.
So what I'm hoping is, we've run 2 for 2 so far on festival submissions. So it seems to be resonating so far. I'm hoping that we're waiting to hear from Tribeca, Sundance next year. But we're hoping to hear from Tribeca. If we get into something like Tribeca, I think some doors may open.
Sure.
To have it, reach a broader audience. So hopefully that happens. I mean, you never know, Tribeca, God knows, but.
Right, right.
But we'll see. And so sooner or later, it will absolutely be available to, for the ultimate purpose of helping.
Yeah.
Some people who need the help. And I just got to tell you the story. This just happened yesterday to us. So we do this movie on suicide. And our neighbor right here on the island, something happened around Christmas time and we don't know quite exactly what, but we actually slept through it. But our other neighbors said, oh my God, what happened last night? And apparently we had EMTs and helicopters and all kinds of shit going on right behind our house. And we slept through it. We had white noise at night because it's so quiet here. We didn't know anything's going on. And our good friend who lives behind us, finally came over for dinner last night and said what happened. And what happened was her husband had a psychotic episode and walked out into the woods and cut his throat and cut his wrists and almost bled out. And it was like, I can't believe that I'm living through this with my next door neighbor when we just shot a movie about somebody who goes out to the woods and takes his life.
Was he a veteran by any chance?
No. And to know him, Gil, would be the happiest, most go-lucky guy.
Wow.
But in talking with his wife last night, very dark, alcoholic stuff that we didn't know about. Two beautiful daughters, both in college.
And he survived?
Say again?
He survived?
He survived barely, barely. And checked into a rehab facility for alcoholism and is now back in New Hampshire working with this company that he works for. Back in New Hampshire, he's not living here. His wife is going to divorce him because apparently there's bad shit going on. We didn't know about. But it's like, oh my God, I'm living through a damn movie
sure.
shot.
Yeah.
Candace and I sat here just slack jawed going, I can't believe you're telling us this.
Yeah.
So it's exacerbated by COVID and depression that happened because of that and the isolation. There's a big uptake in suicide. I mean,
that's why that movie is so important. I mean, I really think it's a very important movie.
Well, and I hope, and I appreciate the comments, and I hope that when we can, we'll start to utilize it in some way. Because the most satisfying commercials of my whole career have been the pro bono work. Yeah. You know, the AIDS awareness and the missing and exploited children and you know, cancer society. It's, you know, because you feel like you're not selling dog food. You feel like you're doing something that maybe makes a difference in somebody's life.
Yeah.
Because otherwise it's just like, you know, it's
absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. But so Al, I'm sorry, you led off with a question about something about that. I don't know how we got off on a tangent.
Well, I was just going to, you have one feature that you did get to complete all the way through just right.
Right. That's how Gil and I met. Yeah.
Okay. So,
well, on a lighter note, the story of how Gil and I met is kind of fun and might be uplifting for our audience at this point. Why don't you start it and I'll chime in as I disagree
with
you.
How did you guys meet and what has that got to do with Just Right?
Well, Gil had done Bucket of Blood, which I guess was your first feature, Gil, is that right? As a director?
Bordello of Blood.
Oh, Bordello of Blood, sorry.
It was maybe. A bucket of blood.
Yeah, it was.
It was like a bucket.
If you listen to our podcast, it was a bucket of blood. Yeah, go ahead.
But and Just Right was my first feature, and I don't remember exactly how it happened, but we got invited to the Directors Guild.
The Directors Guild has this for new members, and I think we were both new members
first time directors,
and they had this dinner in the lobby of this wonderfully beautiful DGA building on Sunset Boulevard. And they invited, you know, these directors, and I know Walter Hill was there because I remember running into him. And a lot of other named directors, but a lot of new guys who just came. And, you know, you sort of walk around and you go, oh, there's a big name director. There's a big name director. But what are you going to do? You're going to go over and say, hi, I just directed my first feature. So you don't talk to anybody and you sort of mull around. So I'm mulling around by myself and I see a guy over there. He's sort of mulling around by himself. So we sort of connect and we go, hey, what are you doing? And what are you doing? And that's how it started.
Yeah.
And then we started talking about our respective directing, you know, careers and what we're doing. And, you know, I left that dinner so totally disappointed. The food was great, by the way. I so totally disappointed in, you know, what was I out there to do? Mm-hmm. But the best thing about it was meeting this guy, Andy Gallerani, who also directed recently. And I said, you know, we're going to stay in touch. He's a really good guy. And I think, We're gonna be friends for a long time.
Yeah,
and that's sort of how it happened.
It's true. It's absolutely true. It's I use the analogy. I remember George Gobel one night on the Tonight Show was kind of he was the odd man out. He had he was in the interview scene, and next to him was Dean Martin. Next to him was Frank Sinatra, and Gobel is talking to Carson. Every time he turns away, Dean Martin is flipping his cigarette into Goebel's drink. And the audience is laughing and laughing, and Goebel doesn't know what's going on. So finally, you know, Goebel turns to the audience and he goes, did you ever get the feeling that the world is a tuxedo and you're a pair of brown shoes? And that's how Gil and I kind of felt at this DGA dinner, that we were the brown shoes in a room full of tuxedos.
Right.
But we found each other across the room, kind of thing, and then did become friends. And Gil, I don't know if you remember, you know, we worked on that one feature film that we tried to get off the ground, called The Event. Afterwards, we got together, and I had a script that after having done a romantic comedy, I wanted something with a little more gravitas. This is a story about about AIDS and a suicide party. When somebody gets together and you take your life in a celebration, and Gil and I worked on that together, which because Gil had been doing his big films and I have just done my one indie movie, but Gil wanted to do a smaller picture, if I recall, that had a little more something to it. So we hooked up on that and did a lot of development on it, and the two writers went nuts on us at one point and just started demanding stuff that was just not going to happen. And,
writers are such assholes.
They can be. But they got themselves hooked up with Julia Roberts' attorney, and he just sold them a bill of goods that you can have the world. And I remember so distinctly, they called me on a Friday and said, well, this is what we want. And I said, guys, you got to really think about this, because if I take this to Gil, I said, he's going to flip out. You know, I said, I want you to think about it over the weekend. And let's talk on Monday. If you want me to go forward with it, I will. But I'm telling you, it's a bad idea. They wanted cast approval. They wanted, you know, all kinds of shit they shouldn't get. Yeah. First time writers.
Right.
And sure as
oh,
hell.
Oh, dear. Oh, guys, yeah. Guys, yeah. Guys, put yeah. your penises back in your pants. Holy shit.
Yeah, I think we suggested with what they wanted, maybe they should try suicide.
And sure enough, on Monday, they came back and said, no, we want to stick to their guns. And I called Gil and told him. Gil went rightfully ballistic, called their manager and read her the riot act. And that was the end of the show. You know, yeah. it never went from there, you know. So
whatever happened to them? Did they ever write anything that got made?
No. The movie, I saw the movie. They got it made. They produced it for $400,000 Canadian. They shot it in Newfoundland. They did get who'd they get? They got they had Olympia Dukakis attached, mm-hmm. which was nice, and Olympia stayed attached.
Yeah,
they had they ended up with Olympia and I can't remember who else, but they I finally went to see it. It played in one theater down in Hollywood at the
New Art,
not New Art at. Right there at Sunset and Fairfax, there's like a Sunset 5.
Yeah.
So I went to see it, and there was like, you know, three people in the audience. And I remember sitting there going, I'm really pissed that I'm watching this movie, and I'm really delighted that it sucks, you right. know. So it went nowhere. It went absolutely nowhere, which is a shame, because the story about AIDS was important.
Yes.
And they totally blew it, you know. And they never did another movie, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
I know after that, but what happened, unfortunately, is that was right before 9/11, and once 9/11 happened, the whole, as you all know, the whole bottom of the world fell out. Mm-hmm. I had clients who wouldn't get on an airplane. You know, we had to circle the wagons and basically protect the commercial business, and so I never got back into doing movies again. Mm-hmm. You know, after that, because it was just like, you know. And the golden handcuffs of commercials, and you know, it's like, okay, right. there you right. go, you know. So, so we never did, you know, get that one off the ground. But that's how I met Gil. That's how we're still friends.
And now you live full time up in what was the name of the island again?
It's Vashon Island.
Vashon yeah. Island. So you are free at last from the LA thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's you know, I love LA. I do. I still love LA. I love the weather. My daughter lives there, so we go down to see her whenever we can, or they come up whenever they get away. If I was going to live anyplace else again, it would probably be back in LA. Truthfully, mm-hmm. you know, I'd like the energy. I like the weather. You know, so but you know, we have a great life up here, and.
Are you working on anything else, or have?
Well, I am. I'm signed on to do an indie show, an indie picture called Baja Triangle. It's a kind of a you know, neo noir, magical realism.
You got pulled right back in, didn't you?
What's that?
You got pulled right back in, didn't you?
Well, I'm a ball of energy. You know, I need to stay busy. So. You know, so yeah, it's so we'll see. We just made an offer to Guy Pearce. So we're starting. We've got three main characters. We need to find the first one, then hopefully we can fill in around him. So it'll be a 7.5 $9 million indie shooting in Baja California. And we've done some good work on the script. I'm really happy where it is. You know, there's a producer in LA who's picked it up, and we'll see if he can get it set up. But we'll see. In the meantime, I'm writing another script right now, a rom-com, I would like to do.
See, man, it's just the storytelling bug, it just never goes away, man. It's an infection. You're infected for life.
Well, the good thing is that I'm not desperate to do it any longer, you know, now, which is a great place to be, because it's like, you know, yeah. So, you know, they can't hold it over my head. It's kind of like, you know, no, I'd love to do it. Yeah, let's do it. It'd be great. You know, you don't want to do it? Okay, no problem. You know, I've got a good life. I'm okay. You know, so it's a good place to be, you know, coming from a purely kind of creative. Mm-hmm. If it happens, if it doesn't.
Oh, indeed. Yeah. It is all the motivation is the right motivation. It's because it's nothing about it. It's all about the project and nothing but.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so it's a great place to be, and we'll see what happens. I just got a text from the producer this morning saying that they'll, we're back and forth a little bit with Guy's agents in London, and they're asking questions and we're answering questions. So we'll see if he signs on. He's been doing some, you know, some indie stuff and working.
What's it called again?
It's called Baja Triangle.
Baja Triangle. Well,
yeah. So we'll see what happens. It's great. It's a great story. It's basically a heist picture. A young girl with an older, you know, abusive husband takes off with her lover to Mexico with $2 million of his money, and he sends his goons in pursuit. But it's also got lots of elements of magical realism in it, and some fantasy. So it's really cool. It's a fun little project, and it's kind of dark and edgy, which is nice. And then I've got a romantic comedy that I'm working on and I'm writing, and I've got a thriller that I finished that I like a lot too, that we'll see what happens with that. Another kind of fantasy film, a big kind of movie, not big in size, a big as in Tom Hanks kind of movie. So just staying creative and busy. And meanwhile, Candace and I, you know, we're taking little trips, go to New York for a couple of weeks,
is good.
Your kids, yeah. It's you know, we've worked hard for a long time. It's you know, it's been 40 years of scraping and working, and it's
well,
great.
You know? Hoping the best for Baja Triangle. It sounds like a terrific, cool piece. Magical realism is always fun to throw into a heist picture.
Yeah.
That's automatically that should be an intriguing combination of elements.
We hope.
It has been a pleasure to meet you and to, wow, I feel like I've been missing out all this time.
Well, you know, it's I'm so glad that Gil reached out recently, because you know, everybody got, you know, scattered to the winds during COVID, and I haven't made that many trips up to Vancouver any longer, and, you know, so it was nice when he reached out and I said, oh my God, this is great. And
one of the great things about podcasting is that, in order to, you know, the need for guests is a relentless maw that must always be filled, and suddenly it forces you to reconnect with all your relationships.
Yeah.
Well, okay, yeah, we need a guest on the podcast, but it's not a terrible thing to have to do anyway.
Yeah, no, it's not. You guys are having a great time. I caught the interview with who was it? The lady you just had on, who had worked with Joel.
Jackie George.
Sorry.
It was right. And it was wonderful to catch up with her, because
absolutely. Was. And that's part of it, is that, you know, you get isolated especially during COVID. People, you know, get retreated to their camps and in some ways rightfully so. But so it's just kind of great to engage and to meet you. Thank you so much for the time. And reconnecting with Gil and Jeannie in Canada, which was wonderful to do that. And you know, he was so gracious and complimentary of the work, which always means a lot to me. All we can do is just keep doing and see where it goes and what have you. You know, so we'll see where it leads. And I know Gil's working on some stuff, and I'm, you know, wishing the best and success with that.
Thanks.
You know, we'll see each other coming and going, you know, through Vancouver or through Seattle.
Yeah.
So thank you guys so much. I mean, really appreciate it.
The pleasure was ours, and we'll, like I said, who knows where any of this madness will lead. And thank you, everyone, and we'll see you all next time. The How Not to Make a Movie podcast is executive produced by me, Alan Katz, by Gil Adler, and by Jason Stein. Our artwork was done by the amazing Jody Webster, and Jason Jody, along with Mando, are all the hosts of the fun and informative Dads from the Crypt podcast. Follow them for what my old pal the Crypt Keeper would have called terrific Crypt content.